This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. I'm joining you tonight from our Lexington, Kentucky studio, and would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. So a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit the website www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening, I'm so excited for this show. He won 2 back-to-back Kentucky Derbies, 2 Belmont Stakes, 1 Preakness, 7 Breeders' Cup races. He's a recipient of the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award. He ranks 15th among all-time jockeys by number of wins, with 6,383 victories, over $195 million in mount earnings. It is an honor to introduce Hall of Fame jockey Eddie Delahousse. Welcome to the show, Eddie.
Thank you, Christine. It's nice to be on the show.
I got to tell you, I'm out of breath after that introduction. I can't wait to spend an hour with you. We could probably spend 5 talking about everything you've accomplished during your career, Eddie. And you're coming to us from Louisiana. Is that right?
Yes, correct. Actually, I'm at the Fairgrounds racetrack this morning. We have a couple of horses here with Ray Seville that I used to ride with. He's training. And so I came look at the horses this morning, and it's a nice day this morning. Nice morning.
Good deal, Eddie. And do you go out to the racetrack a couple times a week, or you stay pretty regular out there?
Yeah, I keep myself busy. You know, I do a little consulting, and I do a little bloodstock work, and I just do enough for to keep me busy and try to stay in the game. You know, I love it, and it's been a great sport for me and a great business, and we want to keep it going. Hopefully, we can get some new people involved.
That's right. That's right, Eddie. I love it. And do you ever go out there to the racetrack? You're watching the horses working in the morning. Do you miss it?
No, because I do it. You know, I do go out. Like, they're running at the fairgrounds right now. But even though I moved back to Louisiana, I'm involved with a little bit of Evangeline Downs. I've done a little PR work for them. So I go out in the mornings, and I'll watch horses. And I still know a few guys that my age is still around, and friends and family that have horses. So I don't miss it because I'm still in it.
That's awesome, Eddie. That's awesome that you're staying
so involved. Yeah, I'm very fortunate.
Yes.
Very fortunate.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Eddie, you mentioned you moved back to Louisiana, and that's where you're from. And tell us how you first got involved with the sport.
Well, I've always been around horses ever since I was a kid. I was going to my grandfather's farm when I was a kid. He just had riding horses, and I fell in love with him at the age of 6 years old. And, you know, I started riding match races at the age of 9.
Wow.
When we had match races here in the bushes on weekends. So you know, I just had it in me to do it, and you know, that's like a lot of people in this world. You know, they find their niche or their love for something at a young age, and some don't. But I was very fortunate I did. So that's how I got involved. You know, just riding match races, and my uncles were trainers, and my dad owned horses, and it just started that way. And then next thing you know, I'm on the recognized tracks. After that, when I hit 16 years old, that's when I went to. Well, actually, I came to the fairgrounds when I was 16, back in 1967. I rode my first race at the fairgrounds.
You rode your first professional paramutual race at the fairgrounds, but Eddie, you said you were riding match races at the age of nine, which is pretty astounding. And we've had several jockeys here on the show from Louisiana, and they've told similar stories of riding match races at a very young age. And my gosh, so many successful jockeys come from Louisiana. And do you think that's thanks in part to those match races? And do you remember riding with any of the other great riders that we see today?
Well, you know, some of the riders are, you know, that rode the match races, and you've probably talked to them over the years. You know, Randy Romero, Craig Perrett, Ray Sabille, Kent DeSarmo, they rode match races. I know I'm going to miss a few, but I guess Calvin Borrell, God, there's numerous others that did do that, ride match races, that got them started, put a little foundation in them. But we don't have that anymore. We don't have any more match races anymore. And I don't think you're going to see many guys as there was in the day, heyday, when they did have match races back in the 60s and even probably the 50s, late 50s, when they had match races. I don't think you're going to see that anymore because we don't have the match races. Like I said, I'm repeating myself. But I don't think we'll see the young riders come out of Louisiana like that anymore because of that.
That's sad. That's sad to think about.
It's because of the lawsuits and the liabilities, and, you know, guys don't want to take a chance and have a match track anymore because of that. It costs too much to cover everything.
You can't really.
You know, it was a fun thing back in the day, and nobody thought about it. I got hurt. You know, I got hurt on match tracks and stuff like that. Well, they loaded me up in the car, took me to my doctor. My dad didn't go sue anybody for that. It was a chance we took, you know. But this day and age, it doesn't work that way anymore.
No, people sue McDonald's for hot coffee, so you can only imagine what they do to the match races. But Eddie, do you have any funny stories, any, I don't know, interesting experiences at the match races?
No, you know, the you hear stories of guys, you know, back in those days, they'd run horses without jockeys, you know. They'd run them, naturally, it was a straight track with a rail in the middle that would separate both of them, both horses. And they'd put a cert single on, a cop girt, and with cans on them and run loose, you know. I've never seen one with a chicken on its back. I've heard stories. Maybe after when I finally went to the major tracks, I didn't go back riding match races. So maybe they had guys run horses with chickens on their backs against a rider. But, you know, that's stories I heard. I've never seen it. So I've never heard any too many. That's the only funny story I ever heard about a chicken with it. Running a match race.
Oh goodness. But then when you were 16, as soon as you could, you started riding professionally. And what was that adjustment like from going to riding match races where you don't
it was a big adjustment because there, you know, it was you rode it. I don't know if you ever rode match race, but it was like riding quarter horses. You only went so many yards, you know, like 100 yards, 200 yards. But when you came to the major tracks, now you're getting into strategy and pace and distance. You know, the races are at a mile, and so it changed the whole dynamics of riding. So I had to learn all of that. The only thing match races gave you was a basic for breaking out of the gates, and it made you a good gate rider. But coming to the racetrack as the fairgrounds going a mile, I had to adjust big time. But I loved it. I loved learning about pace and strategy and feeling your horse, getting to know what you had under you. For quarter horses, you just go, you know. That was the big thing.
Get out and go.
The greatest thing in my career to learn, you know, from my craft. Naturally, that's what helped me get more and more successful.
Who was your biggest mentor during those early years?
I didn't have a big mentor. I observed a lot of good riders back in the day. You know, they had a lot of good riders around here. And I think maybe I'm prejudiced, but I think there was better riders back in the day than they do have now. I'm watching riders where they still got some great riders out there, but I think we had an abundance of great riders back in the day. It's just a different way of them riding. And I see a lot of young riders. They ride all the same. There's not much strategy. They don't give the horse a chance. But that's just my opinion, you know. That's just my opinion.
But riding against so many talented riders, and there definitely were. And it had to be, of course, tougher to find success. And when you first started riding and you had your apprenticeship, did you immediately just take off, or was it a slower process?
No, it was I wound up being leading apprentice 1 year at one of the small tracks back in the, it was at Evangeline Downs. I didn't take off that quickly, no. And some of the riders that I rode with in the match races, they took off quicker than me. But they stayed where they were. They done good as an apprentice, but then they didn't go anywhere. Me, after my apprenticeship, it took me about 4 years after apprenticeship, and things started kicking in, you know. But I paced myself, and I took my time, and I learned my craft better than I think naturally than they did, because they didn't go on anywhere. I don't think they realized that, you know, every horse is different, and you got to ride them different. And some riders don't get that. They never get the feeling, and they ride horses the same way.
And you have to learn more about your horse. Obviously, you want to work the horse in the morning and get a feel for the horse in the post parade. And Eddie, how did you accomplish that, getting to know your horses so well before a race?
Well, just like you said, working them in the mornings, being around them, you know, observing them, you know. And I used to work a lot of horses when I was young, and in my younger days, and it's just getting that feel, Christine. It's learning that feel, and it took a while, but once I learned that feel of those horses and getting to know them, what they needed, it made my riding a lot easier. And that's when you start winning races.
Would you say you got along with a particular kind of horse a little bit better, maybe the nervous fillies or rambunctious colts or just anyone?
I got along with all of them. I made a point to get along with all of them. I figured what they needed, and, you know, you get a nervous horse in the post parade and they wouldn't settle down, I'd go put them in behind the gate. You know, I'd get them staying out there, try different things, even in the post parade. You know, not in the post, but well, if they were in the post parade and they weren't right, we'd break post. So, you know, you try to do different things with horses and see what would work. And then once you figured out what would work and you rode them back, you knew exactly what to do. You didn't have to wait. You just automatically did it. So, because you want to try to save that energy for that race.
Jockey Eddie Delahousse joining me on Jock Talk tonight, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Eddie, did you always, even when you first started out, did you always have aspirations to go to bigger places, to get to the big leagues?
I think when I was a kid, when I saw my first Kentucky Derby, there was a horse Bill Shoemaker rode, I don't know what year, but it was Lucky Debonair. I don't know what year it was, but when I seen him win that race in the Derby and the excitement on TV and the coverage, and we don't have the coverage we have the coverage now better than ever. We didn't have back in those days, it wasn't that. It was coverage, but it's not like today.
Right.
It's much better. So, that's when I knew what I wanted to go after. I wanted to be in the big league. And I knew it was going to take time. But I knew in my heart that I had to work at it and learn my craft. And as you know, you got to work in the mornings. I always worked in the mornings. I stopped, even when I was 51 years old, before I got hurt and retired, I was still working in the mornings. So that's the dedication and the love for the sport and the love for your craft.
And you're hungry. You want to seek out those good mounts and
well,
do everything you can.
It's a passion. You know, it's a passion you have, and it. When you have that passion, you don't want to give it up. You know, you just A lot of people take it for granted that do ride, and they don't know how lucky they are.
Very true. Like you mentioned before, Eddie, we are the fortunate people who found what we were made to do, and it's such a wonderful feeling when you're doing that and accomplishing so many great things. And Eddie, how long did you stay in Louisiana before you traveled elsewhere?
I started in 67, and I didn't leave till the year I left was 1975. I went to Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I went to Keeneland with Ardley Farms. Dewey Smith was training. And I had Bud Amy as my agent, and he was well known. And we went to Keeneland the first meet, and then after that we went to Louisville, and then we went to Jersey. I'd done that circuit, then we'd come back to the fairgrounds. I'd done that till 1979. Although in 77, I think I went to Chicago for a couple of years. For a couple of years in Chicago, then. In 79, I went to California.
What did you think of Kentucky when you got here, Eddie?
Well, you know, it was a big surprise because I drove in that day, got in that afternoon, had a hotel room. Me and my wife, was pregnant for my first child, and it was probably 80 degrees. My agent knocked at the door at 5 o'clock in the morning. He said, you better put some warm clothes on. I said, for what? He said, well, look outside. It was snowing.
Oh, no.
So that was my introduction to Keeneland. And, but it snowed for a couple of days, and then it was cold, but it was nice after that. But I love Keeneland. I had great success there. It's still a great track, and it's always a great meet over there. For the breeders and for everybody.
What was it like riding with a colony of different jockeys once you left Louisiana? What was it like learning to adjust everyone else's riding styles?
Well, you know, the leading rider at that time was Don Brumfield, and I watched those guys. I rode there for, I guess we had a, you know, Christina, I don't remember if we had a 12-day meet or I don't know how many days Keeneland has now or the same as now. But, you know, the first week it was, they had some great riders there. And I observed every one of them. You know, I watched them while I was there and I rode with them. And I was very fortunate. The agent I had and the outfit I had, we started winning right off the bat. I mean, I wind up at the end of the meet, I was second leading rider to Don Brumfield. And that was a big thing. That was a big thing.
Absolutely.
And I, you know, and my outfit, Hartley Farms at the time, they had some good horses. And, I mean, we were, I think Dewey Smith wound up leading rider that year, leading trainer that year. Even though it was my first year to be, first season to be there. But that helped me get going just by having him, just by being with that outfit.
Absolutely.
Then I started riding for other people after that. I started riding for the Whitneys and the Vanderbilts and the Amazon Farm and, might have wrote something for Calumet. I mean, I can't think of all the old outfits they had there, but they had the prominent outfits that were there in those days. Green Tree and, my mind's gone. But anyway, they had outstanding outfits, and I was fortunate to get started, and it just helped my career along the line.
Eddie, I want to rewind a little bit. You mentioned your wife when you first moved to Kentucky. She was pregnant with your first child, and I want to know, Eddie, how did you meet your wife?
At a racetrack.
At a racetrack. Imagine that.
At a Maryland down. Well, her sister was married to a jockey, and that's how I met her. Through the jockey she was married to was Harold Laviolette. Her sister was married to. And how I met Harold, the guy that had my contract back in 1967, he was also riding and galloping horses. So when we went to Van Den Downs after fairgrounds closed, that's when I met my wife through him.
Nice.
And through her sister.
And you two have how many kids?
Just two. I have a son that's 38. His name's Lauren, L-O-R-E-N. He's in California. He works for AT&T. And my daughter's Mandy, and she's 41. She's a special needs person. She's a handicapped person. And she's been living with us all those years, and we've been taking care of her.
Wow. And she's the reason you moved to California, is that right?
Yeah, she's not the total reason, but that's one of the reasons. Because the schools were a lot better then. You know, they were more advanced than they were in Louisiana. They had more programs. So, and on top of that, I had an opportunity to go ride when they had jockey challenges at Hollywood Park. I was invited a couple of times, and I've done real well. And there was an agent by the name of Harry that had at the time that seen what I could do, and he had called me and asked me if I'd want to come. And so it worked out perfect. I knew the schools were good because my wife's mother lived in California. So it just, everything fell in place, Christina. I mean, that's when I went, April of 1979. And I got to ride for Las Barreras. I won my first Oaks on a filly by the name of It's in the Air that I had rode in Chicago. And Harborview Farms bought this mare, this filly. No, she wasn't a mare. She was a filly. And I thought, well, she's going to California. I won't ride her. But by me going to the jockey challenge and winning and people observing me, my agent, Harry, had talked to Mr. Barrera, and they kept me on her. and because Lafitte was riding for Laz at that time, and I rode for Laz's brother here at the fairgrounds, so that helped too. So Laz must have called his brother also, and I rode the filly, and I rode 7 horses that day. I went 4 and ran 3 seconds and won the Oaks, and things just started clicking after that.
I would say so, Eddie. I would say so. That's off to an incredible start in California. 4 out of 7. And I want to hear more about the jockey.
And one of the horses I won for Tom Proctor, and it was coming down the hillside course, which I had never ridden before. I had never seen a course like that before. And I wind up winning that race. And I knew of the Proctors, but I had never ridden for them, you know. So everything just fell in place. I mean, timing, it was just something I wanted to do, go there and try it, and it worked out.
We only have about 30 seconds before break, Eddie. We'll continue our visit with jockey Eddie Dalhousie after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. Congratulations to Jean-Claude Medina for winning his first race since 2014, as he recently returned to riding at Tampa Bay following an injury. Mike Smith continued his success in big races as he finished third in the Grade 3 San Gabriel, second in the Grade 3 Sham, and won the Grade 2 Santa Ynez aboard Unique Bella. Smith finished the week with 1 win, 1 second, and 2 third-place finishes from 4 mounts. Javier Castellano won 2 stakes last week, highlighted by a win in the Grade 3 Dania Beach aboard Major Look. Castellano led North American earnings and finished the week with 8 wins, 4 seconds, and 4 third-place finishes. Finally, the Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Miguel Mena, had a solid week as he won 48% and came in the money on 68% of his mounts. Mena led North America in wins with 12 and added 5 second-place finishes. John Parada's newest book, Half a Chance, is available now at JockeyTalk360.com. Half a Chance is the story of a down-on-his-luck jockey agent who finds himself entangled in a web of deceit and larceny and provides the kind of entertaining read that is ideal for any racing fan. But don't take our word for it. Here's what Hall of Fame jockey Steve Cawthon says about Half a Chance. I read many novels written by Dick Francis when I was in England, and Half a Chance reminds me of them. Full of colorful characters and plot twists, once you start reading, you can't put it down. Visit JockeyTalk360.com for more information. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
You're You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
AP Indy's in an all-out drive, and Pleasant Tap is coming with giant strides on the inside. They're coming to the finish. It is AP Indy in front. Pleasant Tap, one last run at him. AP Indy wins the Breeders' Cup Classic by three conclusive lengths. And then it was Pleasant Tap finishing second, and Jolifa was third, and the time was 2 minutes and a fifth. AP Indy, the Belmont Stakes winner, comes charging through the stretch here. He was up close, then he dropped out of it and came on like a tiger to win the world's richest race.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Folks, I want to take a minute and tell you about something special. As you know, Jock Talk supports the PDJF, and you can too. Check out the second annual Jockeys and Jeans Stallion Season Auction. The online auction is held at starquine.com. That's starquine.com from January 17th, 10 a.m. Eastern Time through January 19th, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and all seasons will be available to bid on. Those will be posted again at starquine.com. And I am Christina McManigal. I'm joined tonight again by jockey Eddie Delahousse. Eddie, we just heard the replay of AP Indy taking the Breeders' Cup Classic in 1992. I want to take a minute and talk about that race. Eddie, what was that feeling like?
Yeah, I listened to it too. It sound brought back memories. I'll tell you, he was a great racehorse, and leading up to that that classic, he was doing so good. But this horse always had feet problems, and I got to give credit to Neil Drysdale and his team that trained the horse, Neil, and to keep him together. But that horse was phenomenal. If you'd have seen his feet, it wasn't drastic, but he had quarter cracks. And the technology we have for patching horses up, and it really helped him tremendously. But he had the heart and desire to win. And as you know, you've ridden horses. The good ones can overcome a lot.
Very sure. Just imagine what he would have been like without those quarter cracks. And didn't Drysdale use a fiberglass patch to repair
himself? I think you're right. Yeah.
That's
I think they still use that today.
Really?
On a lot of horses.
That's
But he was an amazing animal. He ran, a lot of people thought he had an unorthodox way of running because he ran with his head very low, but he was so smooth. I used to ride horses that ran that way where their action wasn't that great, you know. But he just flowed over the ground. And he wasn't uncomfortable to ride. He might have looked it, but I was just a passenger every time I rode him. He was that good of a horse. I mean, you could put him anywhere as you want him to be. He was a horse that just had it all. He had the pedigree. He was royally bred and had the talent. It's once in a lifetime to get a stallion, you know, a horse like him that turns out to be a great stallion and also a broodmare stallion.
Describe that classic to us, Eddie. Take us through the race.
Well, the classic, we had a full field, and he was a horse that you could put him anywhere. And that day he broke sharp. We had an inside post, and he broke real sharp. And I let him do his thing. And then as we go on in the first turn, everything got crowded, and I let him suck back. I let those other horses go on. And he done anything I wanted him to do. The only thing I was a little concerned of, I didn't want to press him the first time, you know, the first part. I wanted him get himself in his stride and let him do his own thing. After that, it was just traffic. You know, will I get through? Can I get through? But this horse was so good. He put you in those spots. When I asked him to go at the half-mile pole, things were getting tight. He gave it to me. You know, we got to the 3/8 pole, started getting a little tighter. Just to get in position, I called on him again. He gave it to me. And once I got in those spots, you know, from the first time to the second time, I knew I was in great shape, because once I called on him again at the quarter pole, it just everything would open up. But he'd put you in that position when you'd call on him. And that's great horses. When you ride great horses like that, they do that. And as we entered the stretch that day, once I got him in the clear, it was just home free. I mean, I called on him. I tapped him on the shoulder maybe a couple of times with the whip, and I just hand-rode him the last part, and he just pulled off. And I can remember a lot of people saying, why you didn't whip him? Why you didn't whip him? I said, he didn't need to be whipped. He was running as easy as a horse could do it, and he was much the best. So why abuse an animal when they're giving you their best and in an easy way? And it was just, yeah, I get excited talking about it still to this day. He was just that kind of horse.
Do you think he would have won the Triple Crown had he not had those hoof issues which took him out of the Derby and Preakness?
You know, I always said no telling what kind of horse he would have been. Stop and think about it. He's running with those issues and winning grade ones and winning classics. And in that kind of condition, not that he was sore or lame, but you know for yourself, they're traveling at 35, 40 miles an hour and pounding on that ground, and your feet are 100%. The adrenaline's keeping them going, and the class keeps them going. If he'd had just normal feet, no telling, I would give anything for him to have that, because I'm sure he'd have been a Triple Crown winner.
Like you said, if you think about it, the saying, no hoof, no horse, to be able to overcome that and to be such
an
accomplished
animal.
That's incredible. Would you say he's your favorite horse you've ridden?
Yeah, he's probably the best classic horse I've ever ridden. You know, he's probably the best one. He beat some great horses in his 3-year-old year, and that we had at that time, and he'd done everything as a rider. Like I said earlier, I was just a passenger. All you had to do is you had your plan. When you got ready to do it, he gave it to you. So I'd have to say he was probably the best horse I ever rode. And I rode a lot of good horses over the years, a lot of good horses, but he had it all.
Well, another good horse you rode, Eddie, was Risen Star, who, of course, took the 1988 Preakness in Belmont. And tell us about that horse.
Yeah, I rode him. I only rode him a few times. But he was a big, gigantic horse. He had to be 17-1. But he was a horse that was very light on his feet. And you know, when we ran in the Derby that year, he had the one hole, but he was flat that day. He didn't show no speed, or he didn't run to his capability that day. And I know they were training him different before they got to the Derby. They changed their way of training him. I guess they thought they needed to put more stamina in him, and they took his speed away. Well, the trainers realized that after he ran that race, and I told him, I said, look, he was flat. I don't know what y'all done different, but I had seen him run before where he showed tactical speed. So that's when I heard they had changed his training schedule and the way they took the speed away from him. So they said, we're gonna put that speed back in. And they did. And so we went to the Preakness, and they weren't sure if they were going to run him or not because of the weather, and it had rained and this and that. And the horse wasn't particular. He had little issues, and, you know, they didn't want to hurt him or anything like that, so they weren't sure if they were going to run him or not, but they came to the decision to run him. And that horse did that day. He showed a lot of speed that day. And I could take him anywhere as I wanted, where I couldn't do that in the Derby because I didn't have that extra, speed in it. But that day in the Preakness, when I called on him around the turn that day, I got through on the rail, and he just excelled. And he wound up winning by 2.5-3 lengths that day. He was a much different horse, but he was a classy horse. I mean, he was a nice horse. And as we know, we went on to the Belmont after the Preakness, and he won that so easy. Mm. It was just unbelievable. And being by Secretariat, they didn't think he could go a mile and a half. Well, they didn't think Secretariat could go a mile and a half either, but they didn't think his babies would carry that on because of his pedigree, but he did.
I'd say he
and
did.
He didn't win quite as far as his dad, but I think he won by 18 and a half lengths.
Wow. Incredible.
So he was an amazing horse, too. He was a good horse also.
I heard something, Eddie, that prior to the Belmont, he worked fast, 33-3, I guess the day before.
Yeah, he worked 33 and change.
Were you?
Half. I put a 3/8.
Wow. Were you worried about that?
No, because I knew this horse could do it and do it within himself. And the exercise boy that was getting on him at the time, well, he was a man. He was an ex-rider. His name was Jimmy Nichols. And Jimmy wouldn't let a horse work fast. So this horse was at his peak. And so I wasn't worried about that. The thing I was worried about, I don't know if you heard the story, that they weren't quite sure they were going to run him in the Belmont also.
Mm. Why was that?
Because he had a little suspensory problem.
Oh, yes, I did.
He had a little suspensory or sesamoid problem, either the sesamoid or suspensory. But after that work and he came back, it didn't fill up or nothing, but that's why they didn't want to run him on a muddy track. So what I'm saying, he had little issues. And so even for the Belmont, they weren't 100% sure. But the vet went over him, and I looked at him, and I thought he looked great. And the vet okayed him. And so, you know, that's behind-the-scenes stuff. And as we know, athletes, they all have issues, whether it's humans or horses, they all have issues because they're so athletic and they try and there's always something going on. But, you know, like I said, the good ones can overcome everything. And so the sesamoid or the suspensory, whatever he had at that time, it sure didn't affect him.
Sure didn't. He ran the second fastest Belmont in history at the time, second only to Secretariat. I don't know if that time still holds, but my gosh, the impressive way that he won. And when did you know you had that race, Eddie? Did you know, I think you made that, you started to creep up on winning colors around the half mile pole. Did you know then?
Yeah, that's when I knew I had it won. When I was stalking her all that time and I knew she was going a decent pace for a mile and a half, but I was stalking her and just watching her. And when my horse creeped up on her a little more without me asking him, that meant she was starting to slow up. So when we got to the 3/8 pole, she was done. She was done. And I knew right then and there. And I hadn't called on him yet. I didn't wait. I waited till the quarter pole before I even chirped on. And when I did, he just, you could feel his power and his stride just after going a, you know, a mile and a quarter, he just exploded. He was a good horse, too, a real good horse. And so you can say at the 3/8 pole, I knew I had won.
Jockey Eddie De La Husse joining me here on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Eddie, let's talk about your back-to-back Derby wins. Tell us about how that all got started.
Well, I was riding a horse for the first year was 1981. I was riding a horse in California by the name of Gato del Sol, which he was a Kentucky bred. That Arthur Hancock bred, and I don't know if his partner was Mr. Peters, and I don't know if he is half breeder or Arthur bred him, but they were in partners. So I was riding this horse for Eddie Gregson. He was the trainer, and I started riding him as a 2-year-old, and we broke his maiden. If I'm not mistaken, at Santa Anita, and then later on, we went to Del Mar, and we won the Del Mar Pituitary. And he was a plotter, you know. He was a nice horse, but he was a horse that had one pace. He had a lot of stamina. And going into the Derby, after the Santa Anita Derby. When he was 3, we ran him at in Santa Anita racetrack. And he ran 3rd or 4th that day. But there's some good horses, and only got beat maybe 4 lengths. And that was going a mile and 8. So then we took him to Keeneland, and he ran 2nd in the Bluegrass. And he ran a great race, and he liked that surface. Coming off a track, you know, California tracks. We weren't sure if he'd like the deeper sandy tracks, but he did. And I knew right then and there, I told Eddie Gregson after the Bluegrass, I said, you know, Eddie, we got a chance to win the Kentucky Derby. Mm. I said, he handles this track, and that extra distance is going to help him. And on top of that, all the good 3-year-olds, they're starting there. Lucas and them had all the top 3-year-olds. And I said, those horses are going to wear out. They've been running hard. And our horse hadn't run but maybe 3 times. Maybe that was his 3rd start in the Bluegrass, where a lot of these other horses were probably run 6-7 times. You know, they ran a lot more than us. But they were speed horses, and they were always challenging each other and running hard and hard. But this horse was just, he'd sit back and he'd make one run with him, and he always was fresh, it seemed like. And sure enough, that year and that day, we get an auxiliary gate, and which I wasn't worried about it, because he was a horse that you could put him, he was one that would fall back and you could put him where you want him. The only thing you had to worry about was traffic in the Derby. As we know, it's not the easiest race to ride. But that horse that day, he broke, and I sell him off the pace. And way back there, I say off the pace, he was probably 15 out of it. and I just let everything fall in place, you know, and waited as long as I could to call on him. And when I did call on him, he just exploded at the 3/8 pole. He was moving a lot faster than every horse, and I knew at the head of the stretch, I hadn't really asked him as far as hitting him with the stick or anything, and he was just passing those horses left and right. I mean, it was unbelievable. And at the 8 pole, I knew we were home free. He just won by 2.5-3 lengths. But it worked out, like I said. All those speed horses, they just killed themselves, and they were worn out. and we came in with a fresh horse.
Just like you said. And to make up so much ground in the Derby, of course, has to be extra difficult with such a large field. Is that the race you came up the rail, or I can't remember?
No, I came on the outside.
On the outside.
I made sure I stayed on the outside because I didn't want to get him stopped.
Exactly.
It was better to lose ground. It's better to lose ground than stop and start, especially a horse like him. He was a plodder, and he didn't have that big turn of foot.
Was that your first Derby?
That was my first Derby.
Yeah,
it was very exciting. Very exciting.
What was the atmosphere like there at the track? I know we've had several people on the show who
for the Derby, it's always a great atmosphere. I mean, everybody's pumped there. Before the Derby, and naturally the winners are pumped even higher after the Derby. But, people just love going to the Derby. It's a historical race, and it's unbelievable. So I always tell people, if you've never been there, at least go one time. At least go one time, and either you'll go back again or that's going to be your high.
Why did he miss the Preakness?
The Preakness, because Eddie Gregson thought the race would be too short for him.
For a plotter.
That's why he didn't run him. It was backing up a 16th of a mile, and that was his reasoning.
Tell us about Sonny's Halo in the Derby the next year.
Well, he's a horse I picked up. He was a Canadian horse. He was a Canadian champion. And the agent I had at the time was Craig O'Brien. And he was at Hollywood Park, this horse. And I was riding a horse by the name of Roving Boy that year, the two-year-old year. And he was champion two-year-old. And Sonny's Halo was champion two-year-old in Canada. Well, unfortunately, my two-year-old Roving Boy got hurt. So I thought he was going to be my Derby horse. And he got hurt a few months before he turned 3 years old. Or I should say the end of the year before he turned three. So he was out. So I thought, we're out of luck, unless we find something. So we kept looking, trying different horses in California. Three-year-old prospects. But nothing was, they weren't that good, So somehow Craig wind up meeting the groom of the horse and of Sonny's Halo, and the groom told him about this horse coming from Canada. This is a champion two-year-old, and not too many people knew about him. So Craig was one of the first guys that found out about him. So he contacted the trainer, and we got to know the trainer, and he wanted us to go ride the horse in the Rebel. And unfortunately, we couldn't go. So we said, we blew that mount, and the horse won. Mm. So, and he won easy, Rebel. So that's when we looked at each other and said, this is a running horse. Boy, he can really run this 3-year-old. So we thought, the rider that rode the horse was Larry Snyder. Great rider, good guy. And we thought there's no way they'd take him off. We thought that was his mouth. Well, we got a phone call. They asked us if we'd go ride him. Hmm. But before that, they tried to get Angel Cordero. They didn't come right after us. They tried to get Angel Cordero. Well, Angel couldn't ride the horse. He didn't want to ride the horse. Or I don't know the whole story. So then they called my agent back. He said, Craig, the mount's open if you want to ride him. We're going to run him in the Arkansas Derby. So naturally we said yes. And Christina, he won the Arkansas Derby so easy. I told my agent after the race, I said, we're going to win the Derby with this horse. If nothing happens to this horse between now and the Derby, there's not a 3-year-old that's going to beat it. And he's a horse different from Gato del Sol. He had tactical speed. That day we won the Arkansas Derby, he was laying second. And going very fast. He had high cruising speed. And so naturally we go to the Derby, it was the same way. He broke up with the leaders and laying third, laying second. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, at the quarter pole, not at the quarter pole, at the three and a half or the three-eighths pole, we wind up creeping up to the lead and got ahead in front. And he was just doing it so easy, so easy. And naturally, as we turn into the stretch, here comes a horse by the name of Desert Wine, which he was a top California horse, top three-year-old. And I knew him. I watched him run, and I knew his running style. And Chris McCarron was on him. And I'm still sitting on this horse, Sonny's Halo, at that stretch. And Desert Wine wasn't making any headway. He was head up with me, but he he wasn't getting by me. So I waited till the eighth pole that day, and I chirped to my horse, and he just left him. And I mean, you could feel him, the girt just opened up, and, you know, he took a deep breath, and he just exploded. And he went on to win by 3.5 lengths. But he was an easy horse to ride. That was an easy Derby for me. Where Gato del Sol, you had to worry about getting trapped and hoping the horses don't stop in front of you. This horse, you know, wasn't a straw in his path all the way around there. So to win two in a row, to win one was exciting. To win two in a row was unbelievable.
Easy Derby, you mentioned, as if there is such a thing. Eddie, so incredible to win back-to-back Kentucky Derbies along with everything else you accomplished. You were inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1993. You won the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award, the Lafitte Pinkai Award. They even have a stakes race named after you at Santa Anita in 2016. Wish we could talk about it all, Eddie, but we are all out of time. Thank you so much for joining us this evening, Eddie.
Well, I enjoyed it. It brings back old memories, and, you know, I love racing, and I hope our higher-ups that owns all these tracks can start working together. I've said that the last 15 years. It's still a great sport, but we need to work together. If we don't work together and get new owners involved to enjoy the sport and buy horses and enjoy horses, we're going to have less and less tracks.
Amen, Eddie. Let's hope they can get it done. All the best to you, Eddie. Folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can listen to. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.